Good morning, I'm Allison Ruttenberg, number 17497, for Mr. Sotelo-Cionis, the defendant appellant in this case. First of all, I would just like to briefly go over the evidence that my client committed this crime. I mean, it's undisputed that the victim was shot and killed by a single gunshot wound fired by a .45 caliber gun. Now, the police detectives made it sound like there was this overwhelming evidence. All these witnesses said that my client did it, and people who disputed that were lying, but there was only one eyewitness to the actual shooting, and that's the victim's 20-year-old son. And the man he identified getting the color of his shirt wrong and getting whether or not he had a mustache wrong. So he got that wrong, but then picked out my client out of the lineup, which is why my client got arrested.
Pardon me, Counselor, I didn't see a claim here that there was insufficient evidence, and I recognize that you're only on the reply brief and not on the opening brief, where you're trying now to raise a sufficiency.
No, I'm just trying to lay the foundation for the kind of whether he was prejudiced by this gang affiliation evidence to show that was so prejudicial in light of the fact that the evidence itself was very weak, tying my client to the crime, that it really was reversible error. So that's where I'm going with this. It is also undisputed, probably, that earlier in the evening, my client was in possession of a gun, a .45 caliber gun. He did get up on the couch and claim that somebody had stolen his bracelet, and whether he was just had his gun in his hand or was actually waving it around, which some of the witnesses described to the police, he had a .45 caliber gun in his hand and said, nobody leaves until I get my bracelet, although he said it in a little bit more colorful language. And then when his bracelet was found on the floor, he apologized. And that could also be the situation of what he was talking to his girlfriend about later in the car of, I really screwed up. That was really a stupid thing to do. He wasn't referring to killing somebody. He was referring to embarrassing himself and accusing all of his friends of stealing his bracelet. So, but what's important here is that gun he had, that .45, was never tied to the bullet that killed the victim. There was never any testimony that the bullet that killed the victim came out of that gun that my client had earlier in the evening. The only expert testimony was that it could have. So that's very important. There's no expert or forensic testimony that conclusively ties my client, and we just have one eyewitness, not all of these witnesses, which is kind of what was implied by the police who testified and then kept calling the defendant and his girlfriend liars because they were contradicting all of these other witnesses. So the issues here are whether these kind of, I don't know, editorial remarks that you made by the police who were conducting these interviews, which were not edited out of the videotapes of the interviews presented at trial, was overly prejudicial pursuant to Rule 403. And tied into that, whether the evidence of the gang affiliation was overly prejudicial. And I think in the opening brief, that's summed up perfectly. Any probative value of the detective statements, which are kind of laid out on pages 7 and 8 of the opening brief, was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice under Rule 403. Detective Dennison and Kreider's statements claim that many other witnesses identified Sotelo-Cionis as the shooter and accusing Mr. Sotelo-Cionis of lying lacked any probative value because there was only that one eyewitness. Significantly, many of these assertions were untrue. There was the only eyewitness, Julio Vasquez. It is not true, as I just set forth, that the evidence against Mr. Sotelo-Cionis was overwhelming, so there was this huge danger of confusion and prejudice arising from the omission of these repeated statements over and over and over again of the detectives saying, you're lying, all these other witnesses are saying this, are you saying all these other people are lying? It's like they're creating the straw man that just doesn't exist to give the impression that there was all of this other witness testimony identifying Mr. Sotelo-Cionis that just did not exist. And this was then all unfairly bolstered by the evidence of the gang affiliation. The district court said that evidence was admissible merely to show bias on behalf of these other witnesses. Supposedly, they would lie because they were in the defendant's gang. First of all, there was no evidence that the defendant was currently in a gang on the night of the shooting. He was a former member of that, I think it's the West Side Outlaws, but he had left the gang when his daughter was born and was no longer a member of the gang, but he was still friendly with those gang members, some of whom were at the party where my client was waving a gun around, accusing them of stealing his bracelet. The victim and his son were not at that party. They were just coincidentally at the apartment, and the victim was shot outside. But they were not gang members. They were not at the party.
Did any of this gang evidence come in before it became apparent that the prosecution witnesses were apparently changing their story from what they had initially told the police?
No, I mean, it was brought in to show their quote-unquote bias, but see, the problem, and this is laid out in all the case law cited, I believe, in page 26 and 27 of the opening brief, any evidence of bias that was necessary came in from the evidence that all of these people were friends. Allowing them to then say, well, they're all gang members too, and all members of the same gang, is overly prejudicial under Rule 403, as set forth in all of those cases that were briefed exhaustively on pages 26 and 27 of the opening brief. When juries hear evidence of gang members, then they start to make all of these unfair conclusions that gang members engage in random violence. Gang members are horrible people. Gang members have the propensity to just shoot somebody for no reason, which is kind of what the prosecution theory of this case was, that my client shot this victim really for no reason at all. He just turned around and shot him in the stomach after just a very brief exchange over a parking space. So that is why that evidence was so unfair and prejudicial under Rule 403, because it led the jury to believe that my client had this propensity to commit this random act of violence. And the reason for letting this in to show bias wasn't even necessary, because it really was undisputed that he was friends with all these other witnesses, that Ms. Diaz was his girlfriend, that all these other witnesses who were testifying he was friendly with. And these pictures that they showed, the prosecution exhibits the pictures of these young men flashing the gang signs. In the answer brief, the Attorney General argued, well, those pictures were probative to show the identity of the people at the party. Well, that was never disputed. It's never disputed that certain people were at this party. And it's clear from the pictures. I mean, the pictures themselves clearly show the flashing of the gang symbols, and one of them in particular, I pointed that out in the reply brief, it was picture 44, or exhibit 44. You can't see anything but the hand signal. You can't even clearly see the faces of the people involved because they're all obstructed. The whole purpose of showing that picture was to just show the gang symbol, therefore reinforcing again to the jury that this was a room full of thugs, this is a room full of gang members, this was a room full of violent, nasty people who would engage in a random act of violence. Therefore, you can conclude that the defendant committed this crime, even though there's no actual evidence that the bullet came from his gun, and we only have one eyewitness to the actual shooting who couldn't get basic identifying features of the defendant correct.
Is your argument that the evidence of gang affiliation is always per se prejudicial under 403?
Well, it's not per se prejudicial, and there are cases, and those were discussed in the opening brief, where if you have to tell a story, for instance, that gang affiliation, activity, and culture are so central and intertwined with the case that it'd be impossible to tell the story of the events without referring to the gang relationship, then yes, the gang relationship between the various actors then is admissible and relevant. But in a situation like this, where all you're using it for is to bolster undisputed evidence of friendships and prior relationships, then it is prejudicial under Rule 403.
But if you have an instruction that tells the jury that it's only to be admitted and considered for bias, what's the harm?
Because clearly that's, you know, that's not what they were trying to do. They were trying to paint the picture of unwarranted violence and propensity to the jury, because otherwise they wouldn't have used it at all. It was unnecessary. It was undisputed that the defendant was friends with these other people. They did not need to get into all of that prejudicial gang affiliation that was clearly done to just bolster this propensity argument that they could make. And if all you could do to get around irrelevant propensity evidence was just admit it and then use a limiting instruction, then we wouldn't need Rule 403. But this is a clear case where Rule 403 was violated.
Wasn't it the case that this was only brought in after these witnesses had changed their statements from previous statements?
Well, these witnesses never did stop contradicting each other, but again, that's not the point, because throughout all of their statements, it was never disputed that these witnesses were friends with the defendant. Adding the bit that they were gang members did nothing to bolster the DA's argument that they were changing their stories because they were friends with the defendant. The DA was trying to get that in to bolster the propensity theory that the defendant was a violent person because he was associating with these violent gang members who were flashing these gang symbols earlier in the morning. It simply was not necessary to make the argument a bias to use this overly prejudicial information. And if there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve my last 3.5 minutes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of People, bar number 38141. As a vision of this court recently recognized, evidence referencing a witness's credibility is admissible to explain the context in which an interviewee made his or her statement. So under that holding, recognizing Lopez and this court's other cases, three independent considerations control the first issue. One, the evidence was admissible. Two, any unfair prejudice was foreclosed by the court's limiting instruction. And three, even if we assume error, any error was harmless considering the overwhelming evidence is not shaping the defendant's guilt. With respect to the first, I think there are two different arguments before the court. In the opening brief, the defense focused on the 608 line of cases and argued that the detective's interview statements should have come in because it constituted improper commentary on a different witness's credibility. On the reply brief, and I think the argument today, focused more on the prior line of cases and argued that it's categorically improper for the jury to hear the word liar. I think there are two fatal flaws to both of those arguments. On the first, this court in James expressly rejected the argument that CRV 608 prohibits evidence referencing a witness's credibility to show the context in which an interviewee made a statement. It cited a lot of cases cited in the opening brief and expressly rejected those cases and decided that it was admissible. Second, and more fundamentally, it did so for good reason. The touchstone of the CRV 608 line of cases, is that evidence referencing a witness's credibility is improper generally because it has no probative value and it undermines the jury's ability to do what they're supposed to do, which is to weigh the evidence themselves. But that is certainly not at all tantamount to the way in which the evidence was used in this case. When the evidence is admitted to show the context in which an interview statements were admitted, it does have probative value. And more importantly, it supplies the jury with the context in which it's supposed to do its job to evaluate the statements that are admitted. So it's certainly the people's contention that the detective's interview statements were properly admitted. Second, even assuming that they're not completely admissible, the trial court's limiting instruction foreclosed any prejudice to the defendant. The instruction expressly told the jury that it was not admitted as evidence. It was only used for context. So under that, I think the defendant's 403 claims were without foundation, because of course we presume that the jury followed the court's instructions and the court was properly instructed the jury. And third, even if we see an error, any error was certainly harmless in this case. I'm going to disagree with the defense counsel that the evidence in this case was not overwhelming. The evidence established the defendant's guilt through all phases of the shooting. The people's evidence established that the defendant had the gun and was waving around on the couch before the shooting. The victim's son identified the defendant as the shooter, and People presented evidence that following the shooting, the defendant admitted to his friends that he screwed up. As for the defendant's contention that that statement could have referred to his false accusations when he was on the couch waving the gun that he screwed up by falsely accusing someone for stealing his bracelet, I think it ignores that the statement wasn't just that he screwed up. He said, "I screwed up, I got it." So I don't know how that can be reconciled with the defendant's contention today that that statement referenced his false accusation when he said, "I got it," which I think the more reasonable interpretation is, what the prosecutor argued and what I think the jury found is that statement referred to the defendant saying he shot the victim. So when we take all those pieces of evidence together, including the defendant's girlfriend's evidence, establishing that she saw the defendant hide the gun in the alley and that he admitted he shot the victim, that the evidence was overwhelming in this case. Turning to the gang evidence.
Before you go to the gang evidence, can you talk about the constant use of the word lie and lying here? And I mean, it seems to me our Supreme Court has told us over and over, you just can't do that. So where does that take you?
Yeah, two responses. I'd say one, I think you're absolutely right. The Supreme Court has again and again told us that prosecutors should use the word lie, but it has been limited to prosecutors.
And really, aren't there also cases that say you can't ask a witness if somebody else is lying?
The prosecutor shouldn't ask the witness whether or not someone lied. And I think that's really, to me, the cornerstone of the rule is that a prosecutor should not imbue his or her own opinion as to the guilt of the defendant, because they're under a higher ethical responsibility. I certainly don't think the Supreme Court has gone so far as to try and regulate what police officers say during their investigations, that a police officer can't use the word lie in their everyday course in interrogating a suspect. I don't think Crowder can be read to go that far.
The courts may not say police can't do this. The question is it admissible in the trial?
And I think it absolutely is admissible for the same reasons that James found that testimony referencing credibility is admissible. It shows context. I think the concern is when if the word liar really does invoke these inflammatory inherent emotions, which is what the Supreme Court said in Crowder, and that's why prosecutors shouldn't use it. When it's put in the context of interrogation, that very same reasoning is what makes it admissible in the context of interrogation, so the jury can see how a witness or the interviewee responds when they use that word. So I would say that it certainly is admissible in this context, given that it's not an opinion as to the witness's credibility, which is always kind of the basis of this rule. But it simply shows the context, and it provides the jury with the ability to see the importance of that context.
Again, before you move to the gang issue, there was an issue raised in the opening brief here that there was a hearsay problem with the admission of this testimony. And I'm a little confused. In your brief on page 7, you say this claim was not preserved, so it's reviewable for plain error. And then on page 8, you say defense argued that portions of the statement should be redacted because they amounted to improper comments to bolster the credibility or hearsay were irrelevant. So was it raised or not?
I believe it was raised, and my memory might be wrong, so I'm hoping the court checks me, but it wasn't raised as to Diaz's interview, because we have two interviews in this case. So as to the defendant's interview, the defendant did raise objections. As to Diaz's interview, which came in to impeach her testimony, there were no objections raised at all, be it credibility determinations. The only objection raised to Diaz's testimony was that the whole thing should come in. But there weren't any specific legal objections as to why that would be improper.
Thank you.
Turning to the second issue on the gang evidence, just a few points on that. In this case, I think it's important to recognize, and I think this court has already, exactly when and how the evidence regarding gang affiliation actually came in. Most of the evidence that's raised today all came in after the witnesses changed their stories. So they presented testimony different from what the previous statements were, and at that point the prosecutor admitted the evidence to establish bias and to give the jury an idea of why perhaps the witnesses have changed their story. That's certainly proper, as this court found in James. Additionally, as this court pointed out, the court also gave the jury limiting instruction, instructing the jury that they could not consider the evidence. Being a gang was not a crime, and is admitted only for the purpose of relationships, which again, I think if we focus on the evidence here, I think it paints a very different portrait than how defense counsel portrayed it today. It wasn't just the way that the prosecutor never presented evidence that this certain gang did these certain crimes, or that it was a horrible crime. It was always within the context of you're both members of the same gang, establishing the relationship between the witnesses and the defendant, and perhaps why they changed their stories. So certainly given that, the evidence was admissible. And finally, as we argued in the brief, the record here, I think, confirms not only that the jury followed the court's instruction, but they were not unfairly influenced by the gang evidence. The jury acquitted the defendant of the greater charge, first-degree murder. Under Braley, the fact that the victim was lust included shows that they weren't so inflamed with passion because they heard evidence that the defendant wasn't a gang, that their verdicts were directed by that passion. So I think on the record, it flatly refutes the claim that the jury was inflamed by this gang evidence. So if the court has no further questions, I thank you for your time and would ask you to affirm the decision of the law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
I don't want to imply in any way that I'm waiving or abandoning any argument in the opening brief. We're definitely not doing that. So let me briefly address this constant use of the word lie, because that is still a cornerstone of this appeal. It is simply not true that the case law says that it's not okay for the prosecutor to ask a witness whether or not another witness is lying, but they can get it, they can sneak it in another way by just playing a videotape with the police officer over and over and over, accusing another witness of lying, and a police officer giving his opinion over and over and over again, saying these other witnesses, you're lying because the other witnesses are saying X, Y, and Z, all the other witnesses are lying except you, how come they're all lying? And it's not that this just happened once or twice, it's happened over and over and over and over, and none of it was redacted. That is all improper, pursuant to all of the case law cited in the opening brief, and it's just plain disingenuous to now argue that, well, we can make a distinction here because accusing witnesses of lying during police interviews is perfectly proper conduct. Nobody is saying that that's what the argument here is today, but that doesn't make it admissible. This was clearly inadmissible for all of the reasons set forth in the cases in the opening brief.
But would you agree, counsel, that even if it's inadmissible, we still have to look at the issue of harmlessness?
Yes, and that's why I, of course, disagree with the Attorney General's conclusion that the evidence was overwhelming. He keeps talking about this gun. This was not the gun. The gun that the defendant had in his hand earlier in the evening when he was standing on top of the couch, that was never, ever established that that was the gun used to commit this homicide. Never. That was just this implication that was floating out here. 45 weapons are very, very common among young men in Denver. There was nothing unique about this gun. There was no evidence establishing there was anything unique about this bullet or cartridge stating that there was something about the gun that was indisputably in the
Well, you have a problem that according to the girlfriend, that the defendant admitted to her that he hid the gun.
Yes, he hid the gun he had earlier in the evening. He did not say, I hid the gun I killed this guy with. I mean, I'm not saying that the defendant didn't have a gun. I'm just saying it was never established that that was the gun used in this homicide. And that the prosecution had the ability to establish that, and they failed to do so. Their expert could only establish that the gun that killed the victim could have possibly come out of the gun that the defendant tried to hide later, that he indisputably had earlier in the evening and was waving around on the couch. And so that brings us back again to these gang relationships. The Attorney General says, well, all we're doing now is putting into context why these people would have changed their stories, but all you need to do that is to show that they're friends and that the friends were trying to protect each other. You don't need this highly inflammatory, prejudicial evidence of gang affiliation unless you're trying to show this additional impermissible inference of violent propensity to commit a random act of violence, which was what my client was accused of doing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent briefing and arguments. We appreciate them very much. The case now stands submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.